We have a couple of updates on stories we've been following here on Eastern Standard. A coal company that purchased some mines from bankrupt Black Jewel in eastern Kentucky is now temporarily shutting them down and has laid off workers. Brittany Patterson has more.
Tennessee-based Copperglow Mining purchased Black Jewel's Lone and Black Mountain mining complexes in Letcher and Harlan counties in August. The company agreed to help pay back wages owed to former Black Jewel miners and rehired many to restart production. According to reporting by the Lexington Herald Leader, Copperglow idled its Kentucky mines and laid off more than 100 workers. State Representative Angie Hatton told the newspaper several employees report the mines would remain closed until at least December 26th. Copperglow did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Dozens of miners spent nearly 2 months blocking a coal train in Harlan County after Black Jewel filed for bankruptcy in July. More than 1,000 employees went months without receiving pay. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
In another update, the destruction of chemical weapons at a site near Richmond. Come January, workers at the Bluegrass Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant are expected to begin neutralizing nerve agent. Two citizen advisory groups got an update on preparation at the Bluegrass Army Depot facility, and WEKU's Stu Johnson has the report.
A neutralization process will be used in the demilitarization factory at the Bluegrass Army Depot for GB nerve agent. Destruction of mustard agent began last June, and so far, 13 tons have been destroyed through a detonation chamber process. Plant site project manager Candace Coyle says it's a whole different approach with neutralization.
Day one won't be, I've destroyed ammunition. It might be, I've moved it successfully from this area of the plant to the next. The next stage might be getting to the point where we then punch and drain it. The next step is then we load it onto the metal parts treater, and then, you know, we continue the process from there.
Coyle says by the end of January, some nerve agent munitions should be fully destroyed. The complete disposal of all mustard and nerve agent munitions is scheduled to be completed by the end of 2023. I'm Stu Johnson in Lexington.
Thomas Wyant is researching and exploring how the modern American Christmas is an artifact of the Cold War. And part of his work looks at the impact of this in Appalachian communities. He presented a paper on his findings at the recent Ohio Valley History Conference, and it was called to our attention by the folks at the Kentucky Historical Society. Given the season, we thought it would be interesting to hear what he has learned so far. Dr. Wyant joins us from Spearfish, South Dakota, where he is an assistant professor of history at Black Hills State University. Greetings, Dr. Wyant.
Hello.
So tell us more about the premise of this work. How is the modern American Christmas an artifact of the Cold War standoff between the U.S. and the former USSR?
Well, so when I first started thinking about this project, I was thinking about how Christmas is celebrated in 21st century America, and thinking about kind of connecting back to where do we get some of these ideas from. Now, the idea of kind of a commercialized Christmas is not a new concept, right? Charles Dickens wrote about it in 1843, but this notion of the tension between secular and sacred, which is really kind of part of the modern Christmas interpretation, we see this in the Cold War, because there's a promotion of commercial ideas, while at the same time a promotion of kind of quasi-religious ideas, all within this context of the conflict with the Soviet Union in terms of presenting and promoting what it means to be American. And that is tied very much to ideas about democratic capitalism. And so through government actions and the actions of private entities, we see the promotion of this notion of consumerism and consumption as part of the Christmas holiday. So that's where I start from.
Okay. And so our understanding of this holiday, the religious aspect of it aside, you're saying kind of evolves out of America's propaganda war with the Soviet Union.
It does on some levels in terms of trying to promote this idea of what is the good life, what is the American dream, right? In the 1950s and the early 1960s, there is this strong emphasis on this notion of suburban white America living in, you know, Cape Cod ranch houses, as far as the eye can see, buying things and making kind of a material world of comfort. And that's promoted both by government action, but also by private entities, and especially through the projected images of television. And so there's this kind of cultural sense of what it means to be American is tied to consuming things. And so Christmas gets very much tied into that concept as well.
When you looked at what was going on in media and primarily television back in those days, back in the 60s, let's say, what did you find? How did you connect the dots there?
Well, one of the things that I think television is a great way of thinking about how ideals are promoted and projected across time and space. So the prescriptive kind of 1950s sitcoms and things like that. But what really caught my attention were the 60s television Christmas specials, the ones that we all kind of, basically every December, it seems everyone kind of trots these out and watches them, right? The Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Charlie Brown Christmas and Santa Claus is Coming to Town, all of those. And what struck me, at one point, when I was working on my doctorate, I watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So it was Christmas time. So I'll watch this. And when my brain shut off and I started watching it, and all these thoughts just started coming into my head about kind of what is actually happening in this special. And it was created in 1964, and it's talking about notions of acceptance and nonconformity and you know, kind of seeing it as an allegory for racial integration in the 1960s, and a lot of different things all happening at once. And I was sitting there, I was talking about all these ideas, and until someone threw a pillow at me and told me to be quiet because I was ruining their Christmas. And it's true. I mean, you start doing this and you lose track of, oops, maybe I've ruined someone's childhood. But the more I kind of watch these shows, different ideas started popping out at kind of different points between Rudolph and Charlie Brown Christmas. I mean, that one's much more about kind of the secular sacred divide. And Santa Claus is Coming to Town with the Burgermeister, Meister Burger, who kind of looks kind of Nixonian and kind of Santa Claus as maybe a hippie. So it's just such an interesting set of ideas and kind of promoting or projecting cultural values of this period from 1964 to 1970 through these specials that we largely forget as we watch them in a more nostalgic way, but they really are artifacts of that moment when they were created.
And is that coincidental to the tensions that were going on between the U.S. and the Soviet Union at the time, or was there intentionality involved?
Well, and so here's where it gets into a really kind of a interesting and difficult thing for historians in terms of intentionality. It's hard to know what the intention is in some cases versus what the reception is. Someone watching it, regardless if it is the intention of the directors or not, or the producers, can receive a message in a slightly different way. Now, as far as the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Rankin Bass, the people who created this, talked about it as Rudolph overcoming a handicap, that somehow his difference made him handicapped, and that he found a way to overcome that and become part of society. So someone watching it and getting a sense of this notion of kind of integration might not have looked at it as Rudolph overcoming a handicap, but overcoming some sort of impediment to his, you know, integration into the wider reindeer society. And that was, so like I said, the intentionality gets a little bit difficult for some of them. But Charles Schulz actually, for the Charlie Brown Christmas, was explicit in his use of the nativity scene from the Gospel of Luke. He said, if we don't do this, who will? So he really felt it was absolutely necessary to have that kind of sacred moment in there alongside the secular. So some of them we can kind of see the intentionality. Others, it's more of how is it being received than than fully the intentions. It's sometimes hard to get at those intentions because people don't write things as to why they're doing it. They just give us that cultural product, mm-hmm. and we have to kind of figure out what does it mean. So,
well, you have investigated how the promotion of Christmas in these more secular, commercialized terms or contexts had impacts on Appalachian communities. What have you found there?
Well, what's really interesting, when I was starting some of this research, I came across a CBS report from 1965 with Charles Kuralt called Christmas in Appalachia. It was a half-hour special or so, and I sat down and watched this. And one thing that Kuralt kind of kept coming back to over and over again was this notion of Christmas as connected to consuming things, right? He, at one point, asks a laid-off miner, you know, are the kids going to have a Christmas this year? Well, logically speaking, of course they will, right? They're Christian, you know, this Christian family, they will celebrate Christmas, but that's not what Kuralt is asking. He's asking, are they going to get presents this year? And that kind of connectivity of just being able to say, are they going to have a Christmas this year? With the implication, are they going to get presents by 1965 when this special comes out? Like, that's just understood. To be fair, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, and I heard those same things. You know, having a Christmas meant getting gifts. And so during this special, Kuralt asks this miner this. He hasn't worked in, I think it was 10 months. And he says, well, what I'm going to do is we'll try to be happy that day, but I don't have anything to give them. And he's really kind of upset about that. And so kind of you can see in that report kind of this notion of Christmas and consumption is very much tied together.
Where are you with this research now? What are you still exploring?
Oh, I'm still kind of early in this. I'm looking at a number of different things. I want to keep digging in on Appalachia and questions about how poverty, in particular, in Appalachia, and notions of Appalachia being somehow different and not quite American because of its poverty, how that affected, you know, its connection with Christmas and those types of things. I'm looking to expand a little bit more on the sights and sounds of Christmas in the Cold War. So moving beyond those Christmas specials to really pull in things like music and to think about advertising, both television and print media advertising, and thinking about who else gets left out of Christmas and what it means to be an American when those two things get tied together in this kind of consumer nature. So the poor or other communities that don't actually celebrate Christmas, can they now start to celebrate a more secular, nationalized Christmas and thereby maybe come closer into acceptance in the wider American community? So there's a lot of different ideas, a lot of things to kind of reach towards.
Okay. And very briefly, I know you have a book coming out in spring. What is the title of that book and what's it about?
Well, the book is Peace in the Mountains, Northern Appalachian Students Protest the Vietnam War. It's a adaptation of my doctoral dissertation, and it looks at students at Ohio University, University of Pittsburgh, and West Virginia University. And it tries to understand why they get engaged with various forms of activism, whether it's anti-poverty, civil rights, or anti-war activism. And the central point I keep coming back to in that one is that it's about citizenship, and that these young people have a definition of citizenship that is both that of a citizen of the university as well as citizen of the nation. And that in that vision of citizenship, it is very much engaged, and it's about the right to participate in the decision-making processes. So I looked at schools that, for the most part, people don't look at. They just assume are apathetic and try to find out what actually happened and why.
Okay, and that's coming out in the spring of 2020.
It is, yes, from the University of Tennessee Press.
Dr. Thomas Wyatt is an assistant professor of history at Black Hills State University in Spearfish, South Dakota. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And this interview was suggested to Eastern Standard by the Kentucky Historical Society. The Kentucky Historical Society is highlighting and supporting the works of researchers like Thomas Wyatt. You can visit history.ky.gov to learn more.
Got a feeling that Christmas Day is near, and the spirit of Santa Claus is here. Such a wonderful time when the snow is in town. It's a hell of a thrill when the sleigh bells sound. It's the time of the year for fleeting glances, when the guy in the store says Merry Christmas. What a glorious night, singing old Tannenbaum. To be cozy and warm when the snow is falling down. It's a wonderful time, bet you more than a dime. The city bell's gonna chime, the Christmas star's gonna shine, and old folks singing in rhyme, Merry Christmas.